To Lewis, the number of birds was incredible. They appeared to cover several acres of ground. The mosquitoes were so thick that he could not keep them out of his eyes to take an aimed shot, so he fired his rifle at random into the mass and collected a specimen, which he then weighed, measured, and described. He was astonished to find that the pouch could hold 5 gallons of water. The white pelican was not new to science. Lewis had not seen one before, but he knew enough about it to call it a bird of clime that wintered on the coasts of Florida and the borders of the Gulf of Mexico. That knowledge came from book learning. He had never been to Florida or the Gulf of Mexico. On August 12th, at 5 o'clock p.m., what Clark called a prairie wolf appeared on the bank and barked at the passing keelboat. The captains had not previously seen this animal or read anything about it, so they went ashore to collect a specimen. But, Clark sadly noted, we could not get him. The animal was a coyote. Lewis and Clark were the first Americans to see one. The captain set a precedent. Millions of Americans who came after have also failed in their attempt to kill the coyote. On August 18th, while waiting for an Indian delegation to approach, Lewis took 12 soldiers to a fishing pond used by the Otoes. The party caught 490 catfish and upward of 300 fish of 9 other species. Beyond flora and fauna, Lewis studied and described the soil and minerals of the area. He was not so good a mineralogist as a botanist. One mineral experiment almost cost him his life. On August 22nd, along with some copperas and alum, he found a substance that appeared to be arsenic or cobalt. Clark recorded, Captain Lewis, in proving the quality of those minerals, was near poisoning himself by the fumes and tastes of the unknown substance. Lewis took some of Rush's pills to work off the effects of the arsenic. By August 23rd, the expedition was almost at the 98th meridian, the generally agreed-upon eastern border of the Great Plains of North America. The sense of being in a Garden of Eden was strong. There were fat deer and elk and beaver and other species in numbers scarcely conceivable. That afternoon, Lewis sent Private Joseph Field on a hunt. A few hours later, Field came rushing down the bluff to the bank and hollered out to the boat to come ashore. When it did, he breathlessly announced that he had killed a buffalo. The buffalo was the quintessential animal of the North American continent, the symbol of the Great Plains. More than any other animal save the beaver, the magnet that drew men to the West. It was not new to science, but of the men of the expedition, only the French voyagers had previously seen one. Lewis immediately detailed 12 men to accompany him to the site of the kill to bring the carcass back to the river. That night, for the first time, the party dined on buffalo hump, buffalo tongue, buffalo steaks. Next to the tail of the beaver, buffalo hump and tongue at once became the meat of choice. In the Garden of Eden, man had but to reach out for his food. So too on the Great Plains, as Clark's birthday menu demonstrated. But this Garden of Eden was also a potential battlefield populated by numerous Indian tribes containing thousands of warriors. As a result, in addition to being a fabulous field for the botanist and naturalist, the plains were also a challenging field for the soldier, the peacemaker, the ethnologists, and the businessman. These tribes were virtually unknown except to a handful of British and French fur traders. There were many stories and rumors about them, most of all the Sioux, but little solid fact. Jefferson and Lewis had talked at length about these tribes on the basis of near-complete ignorance. They speculated that the lost tribe of Israel could be out there on the plains, but it was more likely, in their minds, that the Mandans were a wandering tribe of Welshmen. Because they subscribed to such odd ideas, Jefferson's instructions to Lewis on how to deal with the tribes were, in most particulars, hopelessly naive and impossible to carry out. For example, Jefferson assumed that, although the Sioux were said to be the fiercest and greatest of the tribes, they were very desirous of being on the most friendly terms with us. That bit of wishful thinking led to Jefferson's direct order to Lewis. On that nation, he commanded, referring to the Sioux, we wish most particularly to make a favorable impression. In general, Jefferson wanted Lewis to inform the tribes that the new father intended to embrace them into a commercial system that would benefit all involved, and that to make this happen, the new father wished them to make peace with one another. Lewis's objectives, as given to him by Jefferson, were to establish American sovereignty, peace, and a trading empire in which the warriors would put down their weapons and take up traps. Jefferson recognized that the possibility of resistance to this program existed, meaning there was a possibility that the Sioux, or some other unknown tribe, would attempt to stop the expedition. Jefferson knew, too, that Lewis was, like other army officers of his day, extremely sensitive to perceived threats or slights, and he had reason to suspect that Lewis inclined more toward rashness than prudence. That was why Jefferson specifically ordered Lewis to avoid a fight if at all possible. This brought back some realism to the commander-in-chief's orders. Relations with the Indians were important, establishing commercial ties with them was desirable, but the sine qua non of the expedition was to get to the Pacific and return with as much information as possible. Put more bluntly, Lewis's first objective was to get through, and whatever he had to sacrifice to do it would be sacrificed. That was why the standard of discipline was so high, why there was a cannon on a swivel on the bow of the keelboat, and blunderbusses on the stern and on the canoes. Jefferson, Lewis, Clark, everyone involved hoped to God that they would not be needed, but all were prepared to use them if necessary. To avoid fighting and to promote commerce, Lewis had made a major effort to select gifts for the Indians. In Philadelphia in the spring of 1803, and in St. Louis in the winter of 1803-4, he had purchased beads, brass buttons, tomahawks, axes, moccasin awls, scissors, mirrors, and other wonders of the early Industrial Revolution, along with tobacco, vermilion face paint, and whiskey. On Jefferson's direct orders, he had lugged along 2 corn grinders, presumably to teach the tribes how to make grits. Lewis and Clark scholar James Rhonda puts perspective on the Indian policy of the expedition. These items, everything from ivory combs to calico shirts, represented what the United States offered to potential trading partners. As Jefferson repeated to every delegation of Western Indians, Americans sought commerce, not land. Lewis and Clark were on the road to show American wares. The expedition was the mercantile and hardware display case for a trade empire on the move. Moccasin awls and brass kettles were as much symbols of American power as the medals and flags destined for headmen and warriors. Lewis and Clark, surrounded by bright mirrors and yards of red flannel, offered more than goods. They proposed membership in a system with well-established posts and dependable delivery schedules. The most desired items of all were rifles, balls, and powder. Most of the Indian-held guns on the plains were cheap British shotguns. Lewis wanted to show the overall excellence of the American arms industry, but because of the bulk, he could not carry along free samples. He could demonstrate what his men could do with a Kentucky long rifle, but he could only promise, not deliver, similar weapons for the Indians. The presents, trade goods, certificates, medals, and the rest were packed into 21 bags, each containing a variety of items and each marked for one of the various tribes Lewis expected to encounter before going into winter camp. They began with the Poncas and Omahas, tribes of the lower Missouri, and went on to the Mandans. 5 bales were stuffed with goods for the tribes beyond the Mandans. Thus armed with his orders, guns, and goods, Lewis set out to meet the Indians of the Great Plains. All the tribes of the lower Missouri had been out hunting buffalo as the expedition made its way west and north. It did not encounter a single Indian from St. Charles to pass the Platte River. Then, at sunset on August 2nd, a party of Otoes and a few Missouris arrived at camp, accompanied by a French trader and translator. After an exchange of greetings, the captains gave the Indians some tobacco, twisted together into what was called a carrot after its shape, and some pork, flour, and meal. In return, Clark noted, they sent us watermelons. The Indians said their band of combined Otoes and Missouris numbered 250. They were a farming as well as a hunting people with semi-permanent towns. The captains invited them to a council the next day at their campsite, which they called Council Bluff, across and downriver from present Council Bluffs, Iowa. Clark recorded that he and Lewis also put every man on his guard and ready for anything. The night was a restless one, marked by tension and anticipation instead of sleep. In the morning, the expedition had its first meeting with Indians. Going into it, as James Rhonda points out, the captains had expectations and actions that were deeply rooted in the history of white-red relations in North America, directly linked to generations of forest diplomats. They were preparing for exactly the kind of ritual Clark had seen at the council negotiating the Treaty of Greenville with General Anthony Wayne in 1795. On Friday morning, August 3, 1804, fog hung over the river. As he waited for it to lift and the Indians to come to the council, Lewis wrote out a long speech he intended to make. Clark supervised the preparation of the gifts. The voyagers opened bale number 30 and took out red leggings, fancy dress coats, and blue blankets, along with flags and medals. The sergeants put their squads through a close-order drill, then had some of the men use the mainsail to erect an awning to shield the diplomats from the August sun, while others put in place a flagstaff and ran the stars and stripes up it. By 9 o'clock a.m., the sun had burned off the fog. An hour later, the Indian delegation arrived. The main chief of the Otoes, Little Thief, was away hunting, but six or seven lesser chiefs were present. They joined the captains under the awning. Clark and Lewis were in full dress uniform, complete with cocked hats. The sergeants put the men through a dress parade and passed in review. This must have been the first time the Otoes had seen men march in step, turn as if one, shoulder arms in unison, fire a volley on command, and all the rest that goes into a well-run drill. But how the review impressed the Indians, no member of the expedition thought to record. Lewis then stood to deliver his speech. It was some 2,500 words, so it took him at least half an hour to deliver it, and the translator at least as long to put it into the Oto language. How accurately it was being translated, Lewis, of course, had no way to judge. Nor could he tell how much of what he was saying the Indians could understand, or how much of what they understood they accepted. Lewis opened by advising the warriors to be wise and look to the true interests of their people. "Children," he continued, as Clark recorded his speech, "we have been sent by the great chief of the 17 great nations of America to inform you that a great council was lately held between this great chief and your old fathers, the French and Spaniards." There it was decided that the Missouri River country now belonged to the United States, so that all those who lived in that country, whether white or red, are bound to obey the commands of their great chief, the president, who is now your only great father. In a long, convoluted paragraph, Lewis told the Otoes that the French and Spanish were gone beyond the great lake towards the rising sun, from whence they never intend returning to visit their former red children. "Children," Lewis went on, "the president was now your only father. He is the only friend to whom you can now look for protection, or from whom you can ask favors or receive good counsels, and he will take care to serve you and not deceive you." After giving out the good news about this wonderful new father the Otoes had suddenly acquired, Lewis tried to explain the purposes of the expedition. No easy task, since the only white men the Plains Indians had ever seen were traders, whose purpose was obviously to do business. The expedition had more goods than any trader any Indian of the Plains had ever seen, yet the captains did not wish to trade. What on earth were they going to do with all those goods? The Indians had to wonder. "Children," Lewis explained, "the great chief has sent us out to clear the road, remove every obstruction, and to make it the road of peace between himself and his red children residing there, to inquire into the nature of their wants." When the expedition returned home, Lewis would tell the president what the Otoes wanted, and the president would see that those wants were satisfied. Lewis and Clark were advance men and traveling salesmen, in short, representing American business and the American people, whose numbers and skills were all but unlimited. In the 17 great nations of America, Lewis declared, cities are as numerous as the stars of the heavens. What the Americans were doing, Lewis went on, was untainted by any base or self-serving motive. "The great chief has commanded us, his war chiefs, to undertake this long journey, which we have so far accomplished with great labor and much expense, in order to counsel with yourselves and his other red children on the troubled waters, to give you his good advice, to point out to you the road in which you must walk to obtain happiness." As a good father, the president told his children how to behave. They should not block or obstruct in any way the passage of any boat carrying white men, ever. They should make peace with all their neighbors. Now came the threats. Lewis told the Otoes that they must avoid the council of bad men, lest by one false step you should bring upon your nation the displeasure of your great father, who could consume you as the fire consumes the grass of the plains. The great father, if you displease him, would stop all traders from coming up the river. Do as we say, in other words, or no white man will come to you again, ever. That was an extreme threat, strange as it sounds to modern ears. Without contact with European trade goods, the Otoes would suffer a severe setback in their living conditions and would be seriously vulnerable to their neighbors who had access to guns and powder. But if the Otoes did as Lewis advised them, he would see that a trading post was set up at the mouth of the Platte, where they could bring their furs to trade for a store of goods in such quantities as will be equal to your necessities. Meanwhile, their old traders, whether French or British, could stay among them as long as they acknowledged the supremacy of the United States and gave good counsel. In short, after all that talk, Lewis told the Otoes that nothing would be changing in the next year or two. Next came an even bigger embarrassment. Because the expedition had such a long journey ahead of it, and therefore had to carry so many provisions, there were very few presents for the Otoes. That was a flat ending. How Lewis's first oratorical experience went over with his audience cannot be said, although Private Gass recorded in his journal that the announcement about a new father was well received. Clark claimed, "Those people express great satisfaction at the speech delivered." But he also noted that Lewis's speech consisted primarily of some advice to them and directions how they were to conduct themselves, words that would have served well as the title for the speech. When Lewis concluded, the captains distributed presents. They weren't much. Each chief received a breech clout, a bit of paint, and a small medal with a new father's likeness on it, or a comb. The Oto chiefs spoke next. According to Sergeant Ordway, they were very sensible, but Clark was unimpressed. In his opinion, they are no orators. Still, they managed to make their point. The Oto chiefs acknowledged that they had heard what Lewis said, promised to follow his good advice, said they were happy that their new father could be depended on, and concluded by requesting some powder and whiskey. Lewis was eager to please because he wanted Little Thief and some other chiefs to go to Washington in the spring to meet the new father, so he met the request, providing a canister of powder, 50 balls, and a bottle of whiskey. He also shot off his air gun, to the astonishment of the Indians. He ended the council by giving the copy of his speech to one of the chiefs to take back to Little Thief, along with a request that Little Thief come to the river to council. The Indians departed, the expedition proceeded on. At camp that night, on a sandy point on the larboard side, the mosquitoes were excessively troublesome. Private Moses B. Reed told the captains that he had left his knife back at the council site. They gave him permission to go retrieve it, a simple act that illustrated how valuable knives were on the frontier. 3 days later, Reed had not returned. The captains talked it over and concluded that he had deserted. They selected a 4-man detail, headed by Driard, to seek, find, and bring back the deserter Reed with order if he did not give up peaceably to put him to death, etc. The orders were clear and logical and met the situation perfectly. By making the orders a matter of record, the captains absolved Driard and the others in the event they had to kill Reed and took the responsibility for his death onto themselves. The orders also highlighted the fact that the expedition was in a potential war zone and every rifle and paddle was needed. The captains also instructed Driard to attempt to find Little Thief and bring him to camp on the river. Driard was gone 10 days. The captains moved upstream. By August 17th, they were near present-day Sioux City, Iowa. Toward dusk, Private Francis Labiche, one of Driard's party, came into the camp. He reported success. Driard was bringing in Reed and also a delegation of chiefs from the Otoes, including Little Thief. They would arrive in the morning. When Driard came up at about 10 o'clock a.m. on August 18th, the captains gave the Otoes something to eat, then turned to the business immediately at hand, the trial of Private Reed. The court-martial was formed, The charges were read. Reed confessed that he had deserted and stolen a public rifle, shot pouch, powder, and balls. He requested that the captains be as lenient with him as their oaths would allow. His manly behavior seemed to soften the captains. At least they didn't have him shot. Clark recorded that, "We only sentenced him to run the gantlet 4 times through the party and that each man with 9 switches should punish him." That amounted to about 500 lashes well laid on. In addition, Reed was discharged from the permanent party. He had to give up his rifle and the privilege of standing guard. He would work with and be treated as if he were one of the voyagers and would be sent back to St. Louis in the spring. When these results were explained to Little Thief, he and the others petitioned for pardon for this man. Clark and Lewis explained to the chiefs the necessity for the beating. They must have been persuasive, for Clark recorded that the chiefs were all satisfied with the propriety of the sentence and was witness to the punishment. That evening, after eating, the expedition managed to rid itself of the bad taste from the day's principal event. It was Captain Lewis's 30th birthday. To celebrate, an extra dram of whiskey per man went round, and the fiddle came out, and the men danced about the campfire till nearly midnight. In the morning, breakfast. Clark was astonished when one of the chiefs, Big Horse, showed up naked, to emphasize his poverty. After they had eaten, the awning went up and a council was held. Apparently, Lewis read his speech from the copy already held by Little Thief. The chief then asked the captains to act as honest brokers and negotiate.